This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every single week, coming to you from the mind of Sloan, is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how's it going?
Chris, is that really you, or... I mean, I can't tell. You look kind of like somebody I used to know, but I don't know.
Do you notice the shirt I'm wearing? It's much more like relaxation clothing. And I'm kind of lighthearted. And so,
but
it's not necessarily the same side of me that might actually shoot you with a phaser to prevent you from, you know, getting into my files or something.
Okay. Maybe that's it. Anyway, Well, how's the nice Chris doing?
Doing great and ready to talk about the final chapter of Deep Space Nine once again.
Man, Chris, I love it when we get to this point of the month. It's like when you're a kid and somebody says, we're having pizza for dinner. It's just like that.
Uh-huh. You know, I was thinking the other day, because I love each month when we roll around to this, and this is going to be part 7 of 9 here today as we talk about extreme measures.
Wait, 7 of 9?
Oh, well, now that's for a whole other show. This is part 7 of 9 parts of the final chapter, and I'm thinking in a couple of months, we're going to be through with this, and I like doing this so much that what are we going to talk about next? A series like this, I think we should find another topic.
You know what we should do, Chris? We should do that 6-part series when they get the station back. So that would be a fun series to do
6.
As well.
That's what I was thinking about.
And then we could also maybe...
I was thinking about that. And maybe the Circle Trilogy.
Circle Trilogy, we could just, pick a couple of months and do some of the other 2-parters that they have as well. Just talk about each part. So
here's one that'll make listeners groan. Let's do all the Ferengi episodes once per month.
That or the Mirror Universe?
Now, the Mirror Universe, maybe. That could be interesting to do right there. But we'll figure it out. But for today, we're going to continue talking about the final chapter. And we are here with Extreme Measures in the Mind of Sloan. And Matthew, this for me it's a nice little breather here near the end of the arc with everything that's been going on. You know, usually when we talk about these, we've got 4 or 5 different big storylines going on at the same time in each episode. This is sort of its own show. But it takes place within the arc. It does connect with the virus that's affecting Odo and the Founders. It does help to kind of wrap up in a way, not exactly wrap up, but near closure with the Bashir and O'Brien storyline and their bromance and Bashir's entanglement with Section 31. And yet we can focus on this one story that's going on this week.
I think one of the things I was thinking about while I was watching this episode is how amazing it is that they can focus on one part of the storyline and there's no other storylines going on here except for what's happening with Bashir and O'Brien, and yet it's a huge part of what's happening. Like, the fact that they laser in and focus on this, but it doesn't feel like you're missing something at this point, I think is really pretty fantastic. And it just shows you, I think, the depth of especially these two characters, you know, Miles O'Brien and Julian Bashir. Who would have thought when you first started the series that these would be characters that you would, one, would be together, and then two, that you would be focusing on solely for an entire episode of your last 9-part arc of your show.
Yeah, I agree. So, well, let's talk about the different parts of this. And the one that stands out right from the beginning, and I think I mentioned this in our last episode about the final chapter, I kind of foreshadowed how this one starts, where Bashir's got his hands on Romulan mind scanners that he's going to use on Sloan. And then they tell Sisko about the plan. And of course, we know what Sisko did in the Pale Moonlight to bring the Romulans into the war in the first place. And here, Sisko is like, okay, you're going to bring him in. You're going to use Romulan mind scanners on him. Do what you have to do. Sisko's cool with this.
Yeah, I think that you know, they confess, we didn't want to tell you because we didn't want to make you a part of what we were going to do. We didn't want you to feel like you were obliged to tell Starfleet.
Well, so they say that if we told you, then you would have to go tell Starfleet, mm-hmm. and then that would tip someone there off. But actually, I think what you say is probably the case where maybe they just didn't want to get Sisko mixed up in it. Because actually, they're wanting to lure someone to the station in the first place. So tipping them off wouldn't have been a problem.
Right, exactly. I think too they're two people who are really worried about the captain being a part of this. You know, if they get caught in it, they don't want this to be on the captain's record. They're taking this on of themselves
because. We all know that Sisko has a perfectly clean record at Starfleet, and they didn't want any blemishes, any questionable actions or anything like that to be on his record.
Exactly. Well, and of course, you know, nobody knows about In a Pale Moonlight. Only Sisko does, mm-hmm. and those of us who saw the episode. Everybody else, except for Garak, is none the wiser to what happened. So, but what I like about this, and what I think is really interesting is Sisko again is faced with another situation where he's making a decision that's very gray. Mm-hmm. And I thought what was interesting is that as we progress through the episode, you know, Bashir doesn't really use the Romulan mind probes. He doesn't get the opportunity to. And what happens in the actual part of the plan, the legality of it and the ethics of it are very gray. Do we consider going into somebody's mind? And because they don't end up taking it by force, you know, in the end, they Sloan just doesn't help them, but he's not actively hindering them either, because there's a part of him, I think, that it wants to give it away in the first place. So,
well, yeah. Oh, I agree on that. I do think that he does want to give it away in the first place, but he can't. You know, it gets jumbled when he tries to say it. I do think he is still trying to hinder them at the end, though, where there's all this information about Section 31, and if he can just keep them in there for a couple of more minutes, then they'll die with him.
Yeah, that's true. I think, I definitely, I guess, misspoke on that.
But it's not the same as earlier on where he's clearly trying to stop them.
Yeah. The other thing that, I guess this is where we might just get into the idea of situational ethics, but the person that they're mm-hmm. dealing with, you know, between Bashir and Sloan, this is a game in some ways. And I think Sloan feels like that very much with Bashir here. And so if it was anybody else, I would be questioning the ethics of it much more. But because of the relationship that Sloan and Bashir have, mm-hmm. I almost kind of expect that Sloan would look down on Bashir if he wasn't doing something like this, because this is what he expects of the doctor. And, you know, they have that whole conversation that, you know, he's doing this because he this is what he believes in, you know, he's
well, when Bashir turns on the light and Sloane is sitting there, and then Sloane says, "Oh, you don't have the cure yet, do you?" It's like he was tricked into thinking, you know, he's coming there to get the cure back from Julian. Now, that in and of itself is kind of weird, that if Julian's found a cure, it's not like there's one vial that you're going to pick up, right? The information's going to be in the computers, and I'm sure multiple copies and such. But I have to think that actually Sloane wouldn't be so naive as to think that that was all truthful, that they have the cure. You would think someone from Section 31 would go into it thinking this is very likely a trap.
You know, I thought about that too. And the other part of me thought that they are arrogant enough to think that even if it is a trap, it doesn't matter. Really do think that Sloane underestimates Bashir in this episode. And I don't think that it's out of character for him to do so, because I don't think that the doctor before this would maybe be willing to go so far. But because it's Odo, because it's genocide that we're talking about, Bashir is willing to push the envelope of his own ethics. And I think that's what gets really interesting here. And I don't know if Sloane is necessarily prepared for that.
I think the button they pushed with Bashir is the fact, like you said, this is genocide. They've created a biological weapon. They're using medical science to annihilate the enemy. And that rubbed Bashir the wrong way, to the extent that he's now very angry that, you know, his profession, Starfleet Medical, has played some role in genocide. And that's where he now feels Section 31 must be destroyed no matter the cost. And so, yeah, it is a big change from the last interaction that Sloane had with him.
I think it's interesting, Chris, too, you know, when you were talking about, you know, Bashir in Section 31 and what Bashir is willing to do. I think, you know, that conversation that he has with Sisko, and they're realizing just how far and how deep this goes for them to be able to pull something like this off, has a huge effect as well. I think that they're both, you know, for what Sisko does in the Pale Moonlight,
mm-hmm.
is small potatoes compared to all the things that Section 31 is willing to do for the end result. They are definitely ends justify the means. But I think it really sickens him and Bashir exactly what they're doing, because, as you said, it's genocide that they're willing to commit, and it doesn't really matter to them. They don't seem to care about this fact, and you know, it's going to play out later in the series that who the Federation is will allow Odo to convince the Founders to give up, that they can be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this action that Section 31 takes goes so far that it just, the fact that they have anything to do with the Federation just really does kind of sicken all involved, like Bashir, O'Brien,
right.
Sisko, when he finds out, it burdens them to their core that they need to fix this. They can't be responsible for you know, sitting on the sidelines and not doing all that they can to save their enemy, basically. I mean, it's not just Odo, but they're willing to save the enemy, because that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, because you get the feeling that, I was thinking about Sisko's decision here, and when we talk about In the Pale Moonlight, he brings the Romulans into the war because he feels that that has to be done for the war effort and the entire Alpha Quadrant, and many, many lives are at stake. But at the beginning of this, when he turns a blind eye, I guess, basically, and tells them, you can do what you want to do, just do what you need to do. He doesn't, I think, as a captain leading this war effort, doesn't necessarily want to cure the enemy, because then the enemy is going to be stronger again. So initially I was thinking that it's just because it's Odo, he wants Bashir to save Odo. But now that you say that, I think you're right, that it's just the right thing to do, that it's a biological weapon. You're committing genocide against this race, that a Starfleet officer, that's going to rub them the wrong way no matter what, I think.
Well, and I think that, you know, there's a clear difference between meeting people on the battlefield because you've chosen to fight a war against each other and underhandedly committing genocide against an entire race medically. There is a big difference between that, because you're both, you know, especially the founders, they created this war themselves, so they're responsible. But that doesn't mean that underhanded means to defeat them like this. You know, there's an ethical line that the Federation has. There's this kind of like moral underpinning to them that this just rubs them, like you said, the wrong way. And I think it speaks highly to who these characters are. As much gray as there is in Deep Space Nine, there's a lot of there's not as much moral ambiguity as we all like to, I think people like to harp on with the show.
Right, because I think that a lot of Star Trek fans, especially people who don't like Deep Space Nine or have never actually really given it a chance, they like to point out certain things that Sisko did and try to paint him as a bad person or a bad captain or almost a renegade captain within Starfleet, maybe. And like, he makes questionable ethical decisions and bad decisions. But I think this does show that that's not the, when he does these things, he's doing them for the greater good and what is ultimately right, at least in his mind, what's ethically right as a Federation citizen.
Yeah, I think I really do, when I think about these guys and the conversation that they have there in the infirmary, I think they are reeling from the revelation that Starfleet officers would be willing to commit genocide. And Bashir has that whole conversation with O'Brien about how many people would be involved, and he comes up with the idea of 73 people would have to be involved, and that not all of those people are probably Section 31 agents. There has to be some sort of Starfleet involvement in this to get it done, especially with the fact that it was administered to Odo in Starfleet Medical. There has to be some way that somebody there is involved. And
somebody is. Now, I didn't really buy the idea that 73 people would have to be involved. I think you could have just a very few people involved, and this actually could be completely an undercover Section 31 thing, because Odo is there for, I mean, we don't know if he and Sisko were actually lured there by Section 31, if they set up all of that or not. It's, you know, there's the whole thing with the coup, and which is, I think, separate from that. But once he's there on Earth, you could do it with just very few people, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the episode, and kind of trying to figure out whether that's really the possibility. And I guess I just kind of blindly accept it when I think of who Julian is and trying to figure those kind of things out. But
yeah, although he could have just been showing off.
That is true. That is true. And we wouldn't even know, because he's the smartest guy in the room.
That's right. Well, let's talk about, while we're on this topic, let's just talk about perspectives on Section 31, because we're talking about already how our Starfleet officers see the actions that Section 31 takes, and that's just too far for any Federation citizen. But when Bashir turns on the lights and Sloan is sitting there in the chair and they start talking, and Sloan says, I misread you. I thought you were just a misguided idealist, but you're a dangerous man. People like you would destroy the Federation. Fortunately, there are people like me who are willing to die in order to protect it. what I find interesting, and we see this also in Into Darkness with Admiral Marcus, that these people believe that what they're doing is for the safety of the Federation. Sometimes you see people and you look in our own world at things that are going on, you get the feeling that there are people who do these things just because they like to kill people. They just like to create chaos, that there's nothing else behind them driving it where you truly believe that they think they're doing this for good. But with Section 31, although I don't agree with their tactics and the things that they do, I do get the feeling that they're not doing it to be malevolent. They're doing it because they actually believe that they are saving the Federation and that they're ultimately protecting everyone.
Yeah, that is the one thing that I found really interesting, because you can tell in this episode, because we are in the psyche of Sloan, that he really does believe this. He believes wholeheartedly that people like Julian are the reason that he needs to exist, because people like Julian would be the ruin of the Federation. And it's because of people like him and Section 31 that the Federation is able to exist and find its stability for so long. And that kind of conviction, it's not bought or anything like that. It's just something that's fully believed. In the same way that Julian fully believes that Section 31 has to be brought down for the betterment of the Federation.
Right.
And who's right? I want to say Julian, but... Yeah. Is that the reality? I don't know, because that's the ethical question right. that Deep Space Nine is asking us. And it really makes you wonder, because I don't think that in general people are good. I don't think that. And so we go to our based nature, which I think is not good. I think we have to try to be good.
Yeah. I think that we want to think that Julian is right, and in a perfect world, Julian would be right. But I do think that Sloan and Section 31 have a point. I think that you have to always be on guard, and sadly, you do have to have a mechanism that can operate. I don't want to say operate in the shadows, because I don't like the idea of there being any organization that's operating in the shadows, because I think that ultimately leads to the downfall of a society. But what can also lead to the downfall of the society is not having any mechanism like that at all, and being overly trusting and thinking that by being kind to people, everything's always going to work out, because you do have these other sides that are out to get you, and they don't care how much you want to cooperate with them or work with them. Where the real danger comes is, and what you see with Section 31 here, is it purely an organization? Are they taking these actions to make sure that existing threats are squashed, or are they proactively taking very questionable steps in order to prevent a hypothetical thing from happening in the future? Which is where maybe Section 31 has crossed the line, and it's where we see our own governments today crossing the line as well, where they do things that they're crossing a line they shouldn't be crossing in order to protect us, in air quotes here I'm doing, against a purely hypothetical threat.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Chris, and this just brought to my attention this whole idea. It's from the book we read on Literary Treks, this Deep Space Nine book, and Quark is talking to Ro about the fundamental ideal of Starfleet is flawed, and I liked what he said. He said, mm-hmm. Well, it's all well and good to want everyone to be happy. The reality is that making sure that every world has food, medicine, education doesn't guarantee happiness. As much as the Federation tries to fix what ails the Quadrant, and hell, sounds like they're starting to preach the good news to the Gamma and the Delta Quadrants too, their way of doing things doesn't work for everyone, because no matter how hard you try, or how honorable your intentions, equality is a bogus ideal. You can never make everyone be good, in quotes, all the way they define it. And mm-hmm. and I think that that's really interesting, the idea, you know, we all have this ideal of just what it takes for us to, you know, be good and what it takes for us to have this baseline of a society and how hard that is to kind of come together and coalesce. I think yeah. Quark has a real point here of the whole underpinning of the Federation is very difficult to reach, because the idea of like happiness and goodness and all this are very nebulous without some sort of definitive overarching universal truth of saying this is what's good and we go to that, which in the end the Federation says our ideals are kind of like these baseline ideals of how people should be treated and all that are universal. That
yeah, everyone should
everything
do it
should
way.
Do it
yeah.
this way. Yeah. And
but what Quark also said in that book, in that quote too, is that every time you solve one problem, there's always going to be another one that crops up.
Oh right. Yep. Yep. And I think that this is kind of the thing we kind of see in what Section 31's ideal is that we're not dealing with a kind universe. We're dealing with an imperfect universe, and therefore we're going to need some solutions sometimes that aren't quite so pretty.
Exactly. So I just found it interesting, the different perspectives, because unlike a lot of storytelling where it's very clear, this is the good side and this is the bad side, that's not what we're getting here necessarily, because each side is doing what they think is good and they have a reason for doing it, and they're not necessarily doing it in order to harm people. Now, of course, they are trying to harm the founders here with this weapon, but talking about Section 31 overall and the things that they do, that's not their intent, isn't simply to go around and harm people. Well, let's talk about the reality of the mind, though. When they go into Sloane's mind, and then they're on the station. And I think O'Brien asks, right, like, why our station? And I'm thinking, because it's a lot cheaper than creating another
environment. It's because they needed a bottle episode
We need some money for this finale coming up.
Exactly. So we're going to use the Defiant and the Deep Space Nine because it's easy. I thought that... Obviously, they answer the question. Sloane says, I just wanted to make you comfortable.
Right. Yeah. Nice of him.
But I thought it was really interesting.
But also the fact that they've lured him to the station in the first place, though, it did make sense that it would just still be set on the station.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought that the reality of them walking through these hallways and trying to figure out, you know, which door to open and all those things, and then... it all seeming so real to them. And then I love, you know, they get shot and, you know, they talk about the whole science of why they would feel it. And then what I thought I loved is that they make the choice to like get up, and O'Brien's like, let's go. We're not going to just sit here and take this. And then they're fine. Like the pain goes away and they don't have any repercussions of what's happened. So they're just the reality of what's going on seems so real to them and yet unreal. And I was thinking about that whole idea, Chris, and it just kind of blew my mind a little bit, because it's such a strange concept, because it feels like everything that's happening to them is a real thing. Because then we were talking about on the other side of the orb, which was when they go to the station and in the middle of the episode, and they're being tricked into thinking that they're back. Again, it feels like a real thing. And every once in a while, I'll be watching the episode and it can just trip me up. I think you were saying that same thing happened to you. I just kind of forget, oh, wait, they're not really back.
I have seen this episode so many times, and over the past couple of months, I've watched it 3 times. I watched it this morning, and even this morning, it kind of tripped me up a little bit, because it's just done. It's so believable. It's done so well. And then I love the twist when he picks up the book.
Yes,
he's like,
yes.
It's right here on page 294. It just starts over. And O'Brien is so sure that Ezri's just playing a joke on Julian, and I'm thinking, well, that's a pretty elaborate joke.
Yeah, no kidding. replicating a book that has the pages start over. Yeah, exactly.
But it's done. It's just done really, really well. But I find this interesting too, and I've talked about this on some other shows recently. I don't remember what the topic was, but what is reality? And I find it fascinating. What is the nature of reality? And so much of our world is what we make it through our own thoughts. And in a very, very real way, how we react to the things that happen around us really affect how they play out, how they affect our lives. You know, we can choose to be very positive about something or very negative about something. And then the effect that that event has on our actual life will differ depending on how we decide to perceive it. And on a bigger scale, you know, like the whole world around us is some kind of like collective vision, you know, that we've all agreed that this is what's actually happening around us somehow is kind of fascinating. But what's happening here, like you say, yeah, I mean, they decide that they're okay and they're okay. And they just keep going. And even Bashir saying, I can't get us out. Maybe I'm too weak now. After he gets shot, it's like he feels then that he's too weak to get them out. And even that is just a figment of his imagination.
Yeah, it leaves you baffled in the episode as to what is quote-unquote real and what isn't. And I think the writers really do a great job of that, kind of leaving you ambiguous to exactly how things are happening. And it does kind of give that sense of fear of what can really happen to O'Brien and Bashir here, because we know we're at the end of the show, and Deep Space Nine is just a little bit different than every other Star Trek, so we're not quite sure whether everybody is going to make it or not. We've already seen Jadzia die. And so I really like that they kind of play with this whole idea of reality, and it's kind of a little bit of a creepy horror movie type vibe kind of going on with the episode.
Yeah.
It's nice. It works really well.
And the actual reality of what's, or the scenes that are happening in Sloan's mind, I found interesting too, because it's sort of a more subtle version of some other things we've seen on Star Trek before. Like one that came to mind for me is Emergence at the end of The Next Generation, the end of the seventh season, where the Enterprise is coming to life and we're kind of seeing inside the imagination of the Enterprise all the weird stuff where all the holodeck programs are all mixed together and all the weird stuff that's happening on the train. But it's just very kind of unusual, strange scenes. When Sloan brings his wife over and he says, give me that pad that I gave you to hang on to, and she pulls it out of her purse. It's just very symbolic, right?
Yeah.
Like there's this information that he wants to protect and he's kind of tucked it away in his mind for safekeeping. And the way that manifests itself is that his wife has it on a pad in her purse and then pulls it out.
Yeah.
So I found that interesting. And the difference between him, as I was kind of joking up at the beginning of the show here about his attire.
Yes.
When he's lighthearted Sloan and he wants to be helpful and all, he's wearing something, you know, I just went to the hot springs last weekend. And when you go to the hot springs, you have a robe that you wear around, and it's very much for relaxation. And that kind of reminded me of that with that shirt that he has on. Like it's almost like sleepwear. He's in relaxation mode here versus when he shoots that Sloan with the phaser to prevent the pad from and the information from being given to Miles and Jules here. He's wearing his normal Section 31 black outfit again.
Yeah, I loved they're just the kind of difference that you had in the character. And they do a great job of giving you different sides of Sloan, and that, you know, he's not completely how he portrays himself to the world, you know, this Section 31 agent. you know, total hard ass, willing to do anything to save the Federation, that there's a whole other side to him that kind of lurks in his psyche that is sorry for the life that he's lived and the pain that he's caused, mm-hmm. especially those closest to him.
Did you buy that, though? I mean, I think I did, but did you buy that that's really how he feels, or was that all just a setup to try to stall them so they could never get to the information?
I think I buy it, because I think Deep Space Nine is rife with characters who have more than just one note. And I think he is a character who definitely has more than one note. And partly because he believes so fervently that what he's doing is right. But I think a lot of times on the other side of people like that, there is some doubt or something that has been there for forever. There's, I think one of the reasons maybe that they hold on so much to things is because if they didn't, they would be face to face with who they really are. And I think mm-hmm. that scares Sloan a little bit. And that's what you see, that great scene where he says sorry to all those people. It made it sad for me that he didn't actually get to say that to anyone. And he probably never right. would, maybe in real life. Yeah. But somehow in his mind, he's able to do it.
Yeah.
And what I thought most interesting was is that he would reveal that to just not his greatest nemesis, but, you know, to Bashir, you know, that in some way he wants to, I think, show Bashir that there is a part of him that isn't this guy that you loathe, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think both him, Bashir and O'Brien are taken aback by that. They just don't know what to make of it, because I think it kind of ruffles their feathers are the thought of who this guy is, that they're inside his mind. So I just liked it. I liked that we're just not talking about, again, the black and the white and the one note character.
Mm-hmm.
We're creating some ambiguity here to make it much more interesting, because I feel like if the whole episode was just like guys coming to run out and try and shoot them, we would have been really bored. But giving mm-hmm. us this idea that we might not necessarily know the real Sloan or the full Sloan is quite interesting to me.
Earlier, we talked about how the Section 31 operatives really believe in what they're doing and they're protecting the Federation. And so when we see this scene with Sloan here, I think realizes how much he's given up. Because I said, I think I do buy it. I think he realizes how much he's given up to protect the Federation. And he talks about how that took precedence over everything else. My parents, my wife, my children. He said, I lived in a world of secrets, of sabotage and deceit. I spent so much time erasing my movements, covering my tracks, that now as I look back on my life, I find nothing. It's as if I never really existed. And all along, he believes he's doing something for this greater good. But then at the end, he realizes, like, what about me? And what about my family? And what did I actually do that truly mattered?
Yeah, and because that's the whole question, you know, too, that we as mortals have. Like, if leaving a legacy, and nobody really knows about his legacy because he's an enigma. He's this kind of almost ethereal thing out there. And that really does kind of change the nature of how we see ourselves, especially with when we come to the end of our lives and nobody will see him. The only people that are going to see him are going to be Miles and Julian. And that's crazy, you know? And I love that's a question that gets asked by Sloan in his head, at least mm-hmm. here. What does this mean? Like, what do I look like to the world? And did I just waste it all?
What did you make of his line? He said, my death isn't a tragedy, it's a celebration. In death, I can finally step out of the shadows and prove to myself that I existed, that I lived.
I thought that was a really interesting line. It's a lot of biblical imagery of coming out of the shadows into the light, and that through death that may not be the end, that your true self can be revealed, those kind of things. Unfortunately, I think it's hollow, though, because, I mean, when will his wife and kids find out that he died? How will they find out he died? His life has been kind of erased. He doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's why when I asked you if you bought all of it, I felt like part of it may have all been just a way of stalling so that they couldn't actually get to the information before he truly died.
Yeah, I don't know. It is a good question. Hopefully, maybe some of the listeners will write in and have some good ideas.
Maybe, yeah. So, well, we've actually been talking about this a little bit already, having others in our lives, and Sloan is looking back at his wife and his children and how he wasn't there for them. One part of this episode that I absolutely love is, of course, the bromance reaching a crescendo here between Miles and Jules, and this whole thing where they're sitting at the wall after they've been shot. And I was actually laughing out loud this morning watching it again, even though I know everything they're going to say, because it's like a Monty Python sketch.
Yeah. You love your wife, but you like me more. Like, it, and then it's just...
He's like, but I love my wife. And I know, I mean, just... But you like me a little more.
Yeah. And then he's like, I love Ezri. You do? Yes, passionately.
Shifting gears.
I just like you a little bit more. Yeah. See, there I said it. It is perfect. And I think, you know, at the top of the episode, just talking about you, watching the show, you would not expect that these two characters would be the ones sitting here at the end having this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a really beautiful thing, because the need that they have for each other becomes so clear at the end of the episode, where Julian's better nature of wanting to bring down Section 31 and wanting to do everything he can overtakes him, and his zeal for it and his passion for it is what's driving him, and he can't see the trap that he's falling into, but Miles can. Miles is that simple everyman that sees the job that needs to be done and how to do it, and that we get that done first, and that it these two guys working together are able to pull this off. I mean, you know, Julian's a whiz, but he could never have created all of the mechanical just thingamabobs, we'll call them, that they needed to get into Sloane's mind, I don't think, without the technical genius that Miles is of just pulling things together and creating what they need. So watching these two guys complement each other, it really did, I think, reinforce that beauty of that life is not a Lone Ranger sport. We're meant to live it together with others. And we need that, because we are imperfect beings surrounded by other imperfect beings. And I think we are made better by those that are around us and those that help us strive to be better and to do better, and that we help others do that as well. And that's, I think, the beauty of their friendship and their relationship. And I think it's, you don't see a lot of, I think really, truly great guy relationships on TV all the time. And the ones that stand out, I always think of, you know, like maybe on MASH with Hawkeye and Trapper, or, you know, those kind of relationships, these guys that are really there for each other, and that it's okay for men to talk about their feelings. And we might, you know, like get all like, we're going to go have a beer afterwards, but you know,
you have some whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. Which they do. I love that. And then I loved at the end too. He's like, I need to get home. You want to come over? Like, yeah, sure. Like, it's just, they don't really want to be away from each other after everything they've gone
through.
What's
funny is that he invites him over after the conversation that they have.
Yes.
Where Bashir says, she'll understand, you know, that you did it for me. Well, that's what'll bother her the most about
yep.
it. Is that in it for you?
Yep. Oh, gosh. And I just love that because you can see, too, this is not a way of looking down on O'Brien's marriage or anything. It has nothing right. to do with that. It just has to do with the relationship between two men that you can't have that same kind of relationship with your wife. There's a way that a man can challenge you in a way that maybe your wife can't, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a beautiful part of the way I think, you know, the universe has been created. And so I like this friendship. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the highlight for me of Deep Space Nine, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
But it you're right, man. I was watching this episode the other day, and I'm just like snickering and laughing at this conversation because it's so funny.
It's so well delivered.
It's
by
perfect.
Both of them. It's just great. So, plus, you know, I think 9 out of 10 Star Trek fans would also agree that they probably, in Miles's shoes, also like Bashir better than Keiko.
Oh gosh, I think it might be a clear 10 out of 10. So
10 out of 10.
Yeah, okay. I can't imagine you wanting him to spend more time with Keiko and less time with Julian.
Well, I think we've covered all the, you know, main points of this one. So any final thoughts on Extreme Measures and how it falls within the arc?
I think it's awesome, Chris, that the relationship between O'Brien and Bashir is such a staple of the show that they realize they need an entire episode at the end of the series to kind of cap it off, especially where they know where they're going to go at the end with O'Brien going back to Earth. I think it speaks just highly for the writing, too, that they're able to really pull this off and make an incredibly interesting and fun episode that you can just kind of pop in and watch without necessarily having to watch the entire arc, because there's enough of a standalone nature because of the relationship here that as long as that's what you're going in for, you're really going to enjoy. And I think it gave us some great tidbits there about Section 31, that there isn't an office anywhere. There isn't any of that. It is just these select few people who have this stuff in their brains, mm-hmm. their memories. So finding those people is how you have to bring this down. And honestly, made some great books. Hopefully they're going to be coming up in the Deep Space Nine series as David Mack's going to be going along with Bashir as he works hard to bring down Section 31 finally. So
mm-hmm.
great storyline here. And, you know, fans have a love-hate relationship with Section 31. But I think Star Trek Deep Space Nine perfectly used it without overdoing it or underdoing it. I think they did it just right. So basically, Star Trek Deep Space Nine used Section 31 as the Goldilocks. They had it just right. Because, you know, too much, it becomes overpowering. But I just think that they use it well to ask some really great questions.
Yeah, I agree. Because that's my thing with Section 31, is that just knowing that it exists and it's there in the shadows is enough. And then if it surfaces from time to time for a really good reason, that's great. But it kind of has become a thing in books and comics and even in Into Darkness, where everyone wants to pull Section 31 out of the bag and play with that storyline. And I think it becomes too much. So I do think they struck a good balance here with that. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it is a bottle show, and you could watch this and you don't really need to know anything else about what's going on, because you see at the beginning that Odo's sick and there's something wrong with him, and then you see him cured at the end. And so it bookends that whole story really well. And the fact that they could put a story in seventh part of a 9-part arc that works that way, but still really pays off for anyone who's viewing the entire story, and pays off, as we've talked about, with the relationship of Bashir and O'Brien is just wonderful. So that is it for Extreme Measure. In 1 month, when we swing back around to our look at the final chapter here, we'll be talking about the Dogs of War. So we're going to be jumping right in here to the end, and then the month after that, of course, What You Leave Behind, which, Matthew, I think we're planning a really big extravaganza for that, aren't we?
Chris, I think we're going to have barrels of blood wine. We may have some Dabo girls show up. I've been told Chase Masterson as Leah might just pop in. That would be great. Who knows? It's going to be, I think, hands down, hopefully, one of the best orbs that we do. So I'm just excited. I think, wrapping up this show, there are very few shows that end like this. And it's been so fun to go through this and kind of really dissect and talk about the way all of these storylines finally flow together. And it'll be great to see, you know, what the payoff is and what we think they did really well and maybe even speculate of some of the things we thought, I wish this had happened.
Exactly. I should clarify, show ending like this referring to Deep Space Nine, not the orb. We're not going anywhere.
No, we're not. We still have plenty to talk about.
Plenty to talk about. Also, Matthew, don't forget, I'm building the fire pit right outside the studio here, which we're going to actually set on fire for that recording, you know, for the fire cave scene, barbecue to follow.
Oh, great. Well, Chris, hopefully our Patreon supporters will have come through so I can actually afford that ticket to Japan. Okay. Because, man, so. Is it expensive.
Yeah. It is. It is a little bit expensive right now, so... All right. Well, it's been great talking about Extreme Measures today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
We're on the same page.
Yes.
High five.
This is creepy.
Yeah.
We actually did it, too.
Tried
you guys
to do
missed
a high
it.
Five through the camera, so that was embarrassing, but whatever.
Continuing mission.
I feel like this, like, that's a really great idea for a stoner movie. So maybe for the next project, I don't know.
And the name of the film will be Giant Green Lazy Susan.
There you go.
Earl Grey.
VHS Star Trek interactive board game.
I'm so glad you
brought
this up.
Humans have taken over the Enterprise. You now have 30 minutes to stop me.
The Ready Room.
Because I think your compassion for this species is overriding your judgment. And Archer says, my compassion guides my judgment. Mm-hmm. And I really like that line, because I felt like that really just kind of sums everything up.
The Orb.
So imagine we didn't have Opaka. Imagine we had Kai Winn from the very beginning. How do you think the setup of the series would have been?
Axanar, the official podcast.
So is the full-length Axanar going to be in the same style, the same documentary style as Prelude to Axanar? And the answer is no. No, absolutely not. Axanar itself will be a full-length movie, a feature movie, just like you would, you know, any other Star Trek movie or other movie.
To the journey!
Cable is definitely more suited toward a niche show like Star Trek is.
Compared to broadcast, yes, I think it's...
Yeah, absolutely. It's much more probable that we would see it on, say... AMC than we would on NBC.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
When Star Trek 2009 came out, I made a joke to somebody at some point that J.J. Abrams got all of his lens flares from Close Encounters surplus.
Yeah.
But they just didn't use them all, and he just bought them at some sort of, maybe a garage sale or something.
Warp 5.
You know pretty well which way the insectoids and the reptilians are... Yeah. Are going to come down on any issue. It's left up to the indecisive one. Instead of the 12 angry men, it's the 6 angry Zindi.
Melodic Treks.
Now, as I mentioned, he wrote and conducted the scores for 2 episodes of Star Trek Enterprise in the 2nd season. They are Kanemar and Regeneration. And Regeneration is one of the best episodes of Star Trek Enterprise ever, in my humble opinion.
Literary Treks.
We're trying to keep it light. We're trying to keep it personable. We're trying to keep it fun. if Vanguard, you know, was all about being the Battlestar Galactica reboot of Star Trek, this is more about trying to be the Eureka or the Warehouse 13.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and you can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Trek.fm and the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. And don't forget to pick up the master feed and sample all of our content, because that feed contains every episode of every show that we do, plus some other special content from time to time. And while you're getting your podcasts, take a moment and leave us a review of The Orb and any of the other shows you listen to. We would love to hear from you, and that does help other fans find the shows because it affects how we place in the search results of iTunes. So we'd love to have that support from you as well. Matthew just mentioned Patreon, and what that is, if you're not aware, is it's kind of like Kickstarter, but except instead of a single project, it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a weekly basis. And we have a new home on Patreon, and we've outlined goals that we're working on, things that we need support with, and also different contribution levels and the perks that you get in exchange. Now, you can contribute any amount you want, from a dollar all the way up to whatever, but we have some milestone contribution levels, and we've outlined things that you can get on the low end. Of course, credit for supporting the show and the network, but also digital wallpapers, things like that. And as you move along, you have opportunities to become an associate producer of the shows, to sit in on recordings of your favorite shows, also take part in our content planning committee, be part of the team. We have lots of great perks for you there. So go check it out at patreon.com/trekafilm. That's patreon.com/trekafilm. And we really appreciate you looking at that, and any support that you can give us really does help. And it makes it possible for us to keep our Star Trek talk coming to you each day of the week. If you'd like to share your thoughts on Extreme Measures or anything else about Deep Space Nine that you would like to talk about, any questions you have that we can use for the next episode of The Orb of Mail, our feedback show, we'd love to hear from you, and there are many ways that you can do that. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose The Orb, and that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us in social media. Our username on Twitter is trekfm. Facebook.com/trekfm is where you'll find us on Facebook. We also have a community on G+, and you can send us a voicemail, which we would love to get from you, if you go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, or just go to the show page for The Orb on our website and look in the left sidebar, and you'll see that tool there as well. And the way that works is you just need the microphone on your webcam or your tablet or your smartphone, and you can record a voicemail to us and upload it to us right there from the page. So we'd love to hear from you that way and maybe play your voicemails here on the show. All right, Matthew, when you're not looking at that tunnel to the great beyond and wondering why it's not more elaborate than you thought it would be, where can people find you?
Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, talking about all sorts of different things. So give me that reply. Let me know you're following me, and we'll have a great conversation, I'm sure. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with you, where we talk about the books and comics of Star Trek. In fact, we've just been going through again the Deep Space Nine relaunch. So lots of great DS9 talk there for you if you're loving what you're getting here on The Orb, which you know you are. That's why you're listening. And of course, you can find me at my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not hanging out with Miles and Julian in the bar having a nice whiskey, where can we find you?
I don't think I can down them quite the way Miles does.
Probably not.
You can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And as Matthew said, if you follow me, send me a net reply and say hello. I don't really keep track of who's following me or not following me. And I may not notice that you're there if you don't say hello, but I'd love to chat with you. So give me a follow and talk to me about Deep Space Nine or football or Japan or whatever you want to talk about. I'd love to hear from you there. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/cbrianjones. Feel free to hit me up there too. And then I have my own website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, when I'm not talking books and comics and interviewing authors with Matthew on Literary Treks, you can find me on a lot of other shows: Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Matter Stream, The Ready Room, Hyper Channel, also the official Star Trek Axanar podcast, which I co-host with Alec Peters. All great places to find out what I'm talking about elsewhere in Star Trek. Before we let you go, we would like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They're the best source of audiobooks that you'll find anywhere. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Choose whatever book you like, absolutely free. If you decide not to stick with Audible at the end of the trial, there's nothing to lose. You'll get to keep that book. But that's another way that you can help us keep the orb coming to you every week. So go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.